Hello, this is Sarah Jackman, legal editor of EG, and I'm joined today by Claire Gilroy-Scott, an employment partner at GD Goodman Derrick LLP Law. Claire, thank you very much for joining us today. We're going to have a look just at the employment law developments that have taken place in 2017. I understand it's been something of a fairly milestone year.
Hello, Sarah. Yes, 2017 has really been a big year in terms of employment law, and particularly for bigger employers as well, with the apprenticeship levy hitting those with a high annual wage bill and gender pay reporting requirements affecting those with 250 or more employees.
Mm-hmm. And so can you see a particular effects there in terms of the property professional and how that might have impacted on those particular types of firms?
Yes, I mean, particularly organisations who have a large number of people on payroll, so construction and property companies would certainly, I imagine, fall within these two areas in particular. And I can provide a summary of each of those issues, the apprenticeship levy and gender pay reporting, so that employers that listen would have an understanding of what these requirements actually encompass now.
That would be incredibly helpful. I mean, are you able to talk first just about the apprenticeship levy and how that's impacted?
Yes, of course. So the apprenticeship levy will affect employers that have an annual wage bill of over £3 million. And what it means is that a 0.5% levy has become payable, and that's payable from April 2017. And some are referring to this as a sort of payroll tax. Mm. But the intention is that these additional funds are to be used by the government to contribute to the cost of apprenticeship training, and employers can claim back the levy that they have paid if they use it for training apprentices. Yeah. Now, if businesses who come within that the levy, so if they have this £3 million wage bill or more, if they haven't already tackled it, those businesses should really consider whether they can be using apprentices in the business in order to recoup some of this additional cost to them. And apprenticeships aren't uncommon in this sector anyway, with sort of bricklaying, plumbing, plastering being some of the more traditional roles that use apprentices and have done for many years. But apprenticeships can actually relate to many other roles, and some employers overlook this, and you know, it can relate to some sort of very senior level roles like chartered surveyors, facilities management, and property management.
Right.
There are formal apprenticeship qualifications that can be pursued.
Yeah.
So given this, there should be wide scope for running apprenticeships in the construction and property sectors.
Yeah. Okay. So a big effect this year in that area. Just thinking then about the gender pay gap reporting, how have the practicalities of that filtered down into the industry?
Right. Gender pay gap reporting, that requirement affects businesses that have 250 more employees. Mm-hmm. And at present, the reports don't yet have to be published.
Right.
But the requirement came in April 2017, so that those employers who had more than 250 employees on a snapshot date of the 5th of April, they had to essentially go back over their records and calculate the gender pay gap in their business. And they basically have a year to work on that report, and the requirement is to publish it by April 2018. So not all the reports have come through, but they do have to be publicly available. So they will be Certainly, this will be a topic of interest also in 2018 to see how businesses are reporting, because even though there's a lot of people say there's no real bite to this requirement because there's no penalty for not providing a report. But in terms of recruitment and retention of really good quality staff, good candidates will probably be looking at the reports that businesses are making. And in this sector, one of the sort of grey areas in property and construction is the way that people contract with businesses, and there are lots of sort of subcontractors involved in the sector. And the definition of employee for the purposes of gender pay gap reporting is actually quite wide. It essentially means anyone employed under a contract of service or apprenticeship or a contract personally to do work. So it does bring into scope some casual workers, some consultants and some contractors who are required to personally carry out the work. So they can't, essentially it means that, if they can't subcontract or employ their own staff to do the work, then they may actually be within scope when a business needs to consider whether they have 250 employees or not.
Right. Okay. And do we have any anecdotal evidence just in terms of how businesses are gearing up, what the likely effect of the reporting is going to be? I mean, you've mentioned that just in terms of recruitment and, the attractiveness of a company, it will have bearing. But do we have any sort of feel for how the data will be used and what sort of administrative burden it's placing on companies?
Well, I think it does place quite a burden on companies just to provide the calculations. Essentially, they have to calculate gender pay gap figures for mean and median average hourly pay and numbers of men and women that they have in four different pay bands. So in terms of the calculations themselves, it is quite complicated. And the median is required because it's considered to be most representative of the difference, because it's not so much distorted by possibly a smaller number of very high earners in the business.
Okay.
And the four pay bands are essentially quartiles based on the employer's overall pay range in the workforce, so that the report should identify how the gender pay gap varies at different levels within the workforce. So, these are quite detailed reports. There's also a requirement to calculate gender bonus gap figures as well.
Right.
So bonuses over a 12-month period. If a business is required to do this, they really should be looking at the guidance that has been produced in relation to the regulations, because there are, they detail what is covered by pay and the bonus and the methods of calculation to be used. Businesses are able to provide more information and a narrative to explain possible anomalies in the report, but I think that if a business is caught by this, they really should be running their reports, making the calculations and seeing how they can address a wide gender pay gap if that is what the report is highlighting. Because certainly I think people will be asking that business why there is a big gender pay gap.
Okay. So quite a lot sort of coming down the tracks there, something to watch out for in 2018. Another thing, just looking back again to 2017, the Employment Tribunal fees. Can you talk us through some of the changes that have happened there and what the likely impact is, or have you seen an impact?
There has been an impact. So just sort of going back to the beginning, the tribunal fees were actually, they were only introduced in 2013, and it was quite controversial because the employment tribunals have always been very different to the court structure and process. It's supposed to be much more about access to justice for individuals and workers who are not necessarily on an even, an equal footing with their employer. So the scheme was introduced in 2013, meaning that claimant employees had to pay two types of fees. Firstly, an issue fee to bring an employment tribunal claim, and then later on a hearing fee if they actually wanted to have a final hearing of their matter. And to give you an idea of the costs, the fees in relation to a discrimination claim were around £1,200, so quite considerable for somebody who may actually have been out of work. And there were sort of complicated remission schemes, and it was all pretty much, it was very time consuming for everyone involved in just simply calculating things. There were numerous challenges made to this scheme by Unison, the trade union, and yet they were unsuccessful each time until it reached the Supreme Court in the summer. And I have to say it was really quite a surprise to a lot of lawyers, but the Supreme Court held that actually no, it was unlawful, and they abolished it immediately. So I mean, literally the next day we were notified that the tribunals were accepting claims without payment of a fee. Now, there was a marked drop in tribunal claims being brought during the period where there were fees, and there was a report just a few days ago to say that the number of claims being brought is increasing. So mm-hmm. I think 2018 will really be once we have a bit more time to see the impact of it. But essentially it means that it's now far easier for employees to bring lower level claims like unlawful deductions from wages or holiday pay claims that are perhaps lower value because they won't be put off by the fact that they would have to pay this fee first.
Right. And I suppose one of the things that's high on the agenda now and has been over the last few months is really sexual harassment in the workplace, something that's been really quite prominent in recent months. Are you able to talk a little bit about that and how you see that developing over the coming months?
Yes, I mean, I have to say no review of 2017 would be complete without mention of the hashtag MeToo campaign that has it's dominated the news in the last couple of months. And it is a really important thing for employers to take into account. It affects all sectors, really, this sort of issue. And employers need to be particularly concerned because if anything is done by an employee in the course of their employment, then the employer essentially it will be treated as if that it was done by the employer under what is known as vicarious liability.
Right.
So employers, I think they need to review their workforce and the culture that they have in the workplace. And it shouldn't really be seen as stifling, a lively workplace, but employers can essentially have a defense to the liability if they can show that they took reasonable steps to prevent any unlawful harassment from occurring. And that would include providing training to all employees and management on anti-harassment and anti-bullying and equal opportunities policies, and ensuring that employees are absolutely clear on how they can raise issues internally, whether it's informal or formal issues, so that these things can be addressed at an early stage and not obviously reach the stages that we're reading about in the press. So really employers should be checking to make sure that their policies are all both up to date and sufficient, as well as their training for staff and their internal procedures.
Yeah.
And given that the tribunal fees have gone, it may be that we see a lot of these issues now translating into more claims relating to sexual harassment.
Right. And do you get a sense, just from talking to your clients and sort of anecdotal feedback, that there is some momentum in terms of firms gearing up to look at policies and processes in this area?
Yes, I think that generally speaking, people are being very sensible about it. And whilst, you know, not necessarily facing a claim or an issue, they are taking steps. You know, we've seen a number of clients getting in touch to make sure that their policies are adequate and to talk about the sort of training that should be offered and, you know, essentially what they can do to ensure that or to try to minimise this sort of thing happening in the workplace and to ensure that even, you know, if it does happen, that it is addressed adequately and promptly so that, you know, it limits the claim.
Mm. Keeping on the theme of relatively high-profile topics over recent months, another one that stands out really is Uber and the various cases it's been involved in and the discussion generally regarding the gig economy and employment status within that. What can you tell us about that and what are the takeaways from 2017 in terms of where we stand on the employment position there?
Okay, yeah. Employment status has been a big thing for 2017 and it really will continue on into 2018 as well. And so as a reminder, gig economy workers are individuals who work on sort of short-term gig-like assignments and usually doing quick demand tasks. And this it's a sort of newly developed method of working that's adopted by many different sectors. The cases have often related to food delivery couriers such as Deliveroo, and obviously the Uber drivers is a very well-known case that's been in the courts this year. But also it does, in relation to employment status issues and gig working, it does, translate to other sectors and roles such as security and reception staff. So it's really important that businesses are categorising their workers correctly so that there's no doubt about the employment rights that are applicable to each worker. So in terms of, as a sort of brief explanation, there are three different types of status in terms of employment rights. There's an employee who has a very broad amount of protection. There's a self-employed person who really shouldn't be entitled to any employment rights, and they have some rights to protection in relation to discrimination, but otherwise, they are treated as independent contractors. Then there's this sort of middle category, which is the one that's causing all the problems, which is called a worker. And a worker is entitled to the national minimum wage and to holiday pay and rest breaks. Now, the position is complicated even more by tax status, because tax only has two. You're either an employee or self-employed. So, this has become a real issue where you have Uber drivers, for example, taking this case in particular, who are treated as self-employed by Uber. But their view is that actually there's so much control over what they do that actually they are entitled to certain employment rights as workers. And essentially, this year, the Uber case went to the Employment Appeal Tribunal, who agreed with last year's ruling that the Uber drivers really were workers and in terms of their employment rights, and therefore entitled to national minimum wage, paid rest breaks and holiday pay, which, given the number of drivers in question, is quite a considerable amount of compensation and change in contractual relationships with the drivers that Uber will have to consider. And that case is actually going to be appealed to the Court of Appeal in 2018. Mm-hmm. So that question of employment status will obviously be one to watch in 2018 as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Another, I guess, recently high profile publication to come out of 2017 was the Taylor Review of Modern Working Practices. Are you able to give our listeners just a bit of information about what that entailed and what really are the things to come out of that report?
Well, yeah, I mean, the Taylor Review follows on nicely from the issue of employment status. And it was essentially a review of modern working practices to identify a good strategy to provide good work for all and the, you know, the sort of premise that everyone should enjoy a sort of baseline of protection and be given routes to enable progression at work. And unsurprisingly, the Taylor Review highlights the issue of employment status a good deal and does make a lot of recommendations to try and address and rectify the current status of uncertainty surrounding various methods of working practice like gig economy working and contractors. And just in terms of some of the recommendations, one is that the category of worker is redefined and that there's a complete overhaul of the legal tests which are used to determine worker status. You know, present, it's pretty much left to a tribunal to determine it, which what the Taylor Review is saying is, well, it really shouldn't have to get that far. It should be you should be able to identify a worker status at the beginning of the relationship. Then they have suggested that individuals who are currently known as workers are actually instead referred to as dependent contractors to distinguish them a little bit more from self-employed independent contractors. They've also suggested that there should be more consistency between their employment status for employment rights and their status for tax. Because obviously that's a big confusion for people at the moment. And just another recommendation is that workers are given the right to have their written terms right at the beginning of a contract and employees as well. I mean, currently only employees are entitled to a statement of main terms and even then only after 2 months of employment. I mean, I don't know how that recommendation will go down, because if some people are working on very short-term assignments, producing a statement of written terms may be overkill. You know, it might be hard to do in practical, in administrative terms. But those are the sort of recommendations being made.
Hmm.
And it will be interesting to see how they, you know, whether they are actually acted upon.
Yes, I mean, I suppose that was my next question. You know, to what extent do you see employers, you know, picking up and really running with this?
Well, I mean, I think that it's not so much going to be in the hands of the employers, as opposed to, you know, I think that the government is actually going to need to be addressing this. And as a result of the sort of growing scrutiny of the gig economy, and obviously this Taylor Review, there is now some draft legislation that's been jointly prepared by the Work and Pension Select Committee and the Business and Energy and Industrial Strategy Committee. And that legislation is based largely on the recommendations of the Taylor Review, with the aim of sort of closing these loopholes that currently allow potential exploitation of workers like gig economy workers. And in particular, that legislation looks to clarify definitions of employment status and to start a new status of worker by default, so that rather than an individual having the burden of going to the courts and tribunals to prove their status, this sort of new regime would place the onus on the companies to prove otherwise, so shifting that focus and shifting the focus on employers to justify the reasons why their workers don't benefit from the sort of basic employment rights.
Mm.
So the government is expected to issue a full response in due course, and this is another one then to watch out for in 2018.
Yeah. Okay. Before we move on to fuller discussion of 2018 and what's actually scheduled for next year, one thing we should probably touch on is just holiday pay claims. What can you tell us about that?
Right. Well, holiday pay claims had sort of been put to bed about a year ago when the government, there were a lot of claims that came through the courts allowing employees to claim backdated holiday pay claim, backdated holiday pay when they had not been entitled to it. The government about 2 or 3 years ago put a limitation on that to say that they could only claim back for 2 years. But a case has been going through the courts in 2017, which went to the European Court and was heard in March 2017. And the European Court issued their judgment on the 29th of November 2017. And they essentially said that actually, no, if a worker has been incorrectly classified as self-employed, and therefore he has been denied the right to take paid annual leave, and that's essentially out of his hands, then he should be entitled to claim back pay for the entire period of the engagement. Now, in this case, the individual had been working for 13 years. He was actually dismissed when he turned 65, and he successfully claimed age discrimination, and which was settled, but this holiday pay issue has been going through the courts. This is a potential issue, and that case is going back to the Court of Appeal in 2018. So it is something to watch out for.
Okay.
I should probably mention I actually have been acting pro bono for the individual. So I know quite a bit about that case and the impact that it will have, particularly on gig economy workers who now really do have, they don't have the worry of having to essentially sue somebody who is offering them work on the basis, because they're deterred at the moment from doing that because they're probably less likely to be offered more work in the future. So what this case is essentially saying is that workers like that can wait till the end and then make a claim for the holiday pay if they have been denied it throughout the contract.
Yeah, okay. So that's then to watch out for in 2018. Some further court guidance expected in relation to the gig economy. In terms of other substantive events for 2018, what do we need to be aware of?
Right. Well, I think employers will be relieved to know that there is actually there's very little on the legislative agenda for 2018. Mostly the issues will be the ones that are going through the courts and tribunals on employment status and holiday pay. The big thing in 2018 in terms of legislation is the GDPR, which is the General Data Protection Regulation. And they come into effect on the 25th of May. And what that does is it introduces a single legal framework for data protection across the European economic area. Now, whilst the GDPR does contain and stand by many of the same data protection principles that we already have in place under the Data Protection Act, it does impose some extra duties on data controllers and processors. So it is something that businesses will need to be aware of. Data protection has a sort of wider focus than simply employment. But in terms of employer obligations, the main issues for them to think about are how they deal with data subject access requests, because there are some changes to that process, and also the consent how they are able to process data lawfully. So those are the sort of two aspects for employers to think about, really. Mm-hmm. In terms of the process of dealing with a subject access request, there's no longer, basically an employer can just simply request the data that they have on them. They don't have to pay a fee, which is currently the case, unless their request is sort of excessive or unfounded. And then again, the fee would only be to cover administrative costs. There's also a tighter deadline on responding to a data subject access request. So this is now within 1 month of receiving the request. now in the terms of when the GDPR comes in May. In some circumstances, it's thought that it can be extended, but in most cases, the data will need to be provided within a month.
Right. Will some industries be more heavily affected than others? I mean, just thinking in terms of the property industry, I mean, would that be, you know, disproportionately affected?
Well, I think the property industry, because you have so many individuals who are engaged in various roles, and, you know, as I said, it doesn't apply just simply to employees. It's any individual who can be identified, and the personal data that is held and processed about them. So businesses are going to need to ensure that they have the necessary consents in place from those individuals to process the data that they have, or otherwise that you know their right to process the data falls within a legal obligation that they have. So, for example, employers have to process data about employees for the purpose of the employment relationship and the employment contract.
Yes.
But generally, you know. This is something that will affect all sectors, and it also affects the data that people hold about their clients. So it does have to be looked at very carefully. And if businesses haven't done it yet, they really should be looking at it so that they are prepared for May and the changes in May.
I suppose that brings me really onto the sort of final theme, and one that's been heavily discussed on the mainstream sort of political agenda, which obviously is Brexit, employment law, and a lot of it stems from what comes from European directives. How do you see that employment law is going to change in the future? I mean, do you get a sense of whether it will change, whether we'll adhere to the existing rules? How do you think things will shake out?
Right. Well, I mean, the difficulty with Brexit is it's so unknown. But our understanding is at present that the employment law, that when we leave the European Union in March 2019, what will happen then is that all existing law will be enshrined in UK law, and that then the government will gradually repeal. They'll sort of pick bits that don't quite work for us and repeal that. And it's probably unlikely that there are going to be sort of early radical reforms. There's also some talk there being a sort of transitional period where a European Court will still have some jurisdiction. And it's unclear whether that's also going to apply in employment cases. But there is certainly a feeling that there are some areas of law that may be targeted. Some mention TUPE, which is when it protects employees when a business that they work for is transferred to another business. It gives employees protection and of continuation of employment and protection in relation to their terms of employment. Other people have mentioned holiday pay under the working time regulations, but it's slightly unclear really, because the way that the UK has, or England has, we've implemented both of those original directives from Europe, we've actually done a little bit more in some of the cases. Like, for example, holiday pay. In England, you're entitled to 5.6 weeks of leave a year. So that works out at 28 days. In the European Working Time Directive, it's actually only 20 days. So it's hard to know which will change, but there will certainly be changes, and we hope it will be simplified.
Okay. Claire, that's a fascinating roundup of the changes this year and a look ahead to next year. I know it's much quieter next year, but I mean, inevitably there'll be cases, the ramifications of those, and I guess preparing for Brexit and you know, any sort of future reports that come out. So I imagine, although we don't have much timetabled now, there's inevitably going to be things that come a bit further down the line. So it'd be interesting to see how next year does shape up. But thank you very much for the detail you've given us today. It's been absolutely fascinating.
You're welcome.
Thank you. That was Claire Gilroy-Scott, partner at Goodman Derrick. Thank you.